One patient who got fed up waiting to see her doctor decided to fight back. Should we follow her example? This is The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Surveys show that patients hate long waits in a doctor's office. Dr. Pamela Weibel understands why patients get angry.
I think the problem arises when you tell somebody their appointment is at 3 o'clock and they have childcare issues and really need their hourly wage and they have no idea that it's going to be a two-hour wait. You really create a lot of animosity before the appointment ever starts.
Are there ways to reduce the frustration for both physicians and patients?
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, solving the time problem and learning why doctors' sleep hours matter to your health.
Welcome to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. Surveys show that patients hate long waits to see their doctors. One woman has stirred up quite a controversy by turning the tables on her doctors. No, she doesn't make them wait. Instead, if she has to wait too long, she submits a bill.
We're talking today with Elaine Farstad. She has had 14 years of experience in the field of information management, and she's currently a full-time student at North Carolina State University. Elaine, welcome to the People's Pharmacy.
Thank you, Terry.
Elaine, you know, when people are surveyed about their experience in a doctor's office, the thing that comes up over and over again that really bothers them, it's the one thing that makes the experience really awful, is the wait times.
Yeah.
And you had an interesting experience. Will you share it with us, please?
Sure. So I've had the opportunity to think about this for a while, and I realize that doctor's offices, in terms of business models, you know, can't always know exactly how much time somebody can need. So inherent in the business model may be a little bit of a wait. But I've had some experiences with excessive waits, and I doubt if I'm unique. And I had an experience that pushed me kind of over the edge, if you would. I was working as an hourly consultant for Boeing in Seattle. I later became a full-time staff member, but I was an hourly consultant at the time. And I had an appointment in downtown Seattle. Now, if you know Seattle, it's a pain in the neck to drive and navigate, you know. So I got to downtown, paid the downtown parking, and was waiting. And it was going into its second hour. It was a very good doctor.
You were into your second hour of waiting.
Yes. And I was an hourly consultant at a company that wouldn't let you work past five. So I was literally losing. I knew how much. I was literally losing my hourly wage by waiting. And I thought, well, this is ridiculous. So I billed him for the wages that I lost, the actual wages that I lost, and explained the situation. And I received a personal check from that doctor, not from the hospital, not from the clinic, but from the doctor himself. You know, I was really angry, and I tried to, I tried to not express anger. I tried to remain businesslike and just say, this is what I actually lost by waiting for you.
How much was it?
It was $47 an hour times two. I was a regular patient of his. This wasn't normal. I usually waited about a half an hour, which, you know, I'm willing to do. In thinking about it more, since this has become an issue and I've been asked about it a lot, I realized for me it would make a huge difference if a doctor's office would pick up the phone and call you and say, we're running an hour late. Can you come in an hour later or do you need to reschedule? That's all it would take. That's it. That way I'm not waiting on you if you're running behind. I'm being productive somewhere else.
You know, I suspect that there are an awful lot of people who feel the same way that you do. And perhaps that's why your story has touched such a nerve. Tell us what happened.
I wasn't trying to become a poster child for this issue. I told my friend, Dr. Pamela Weibel, I became an accidental activist. This is just something, you know, the first time I did it, I was literally writing out my invoices to Boeing, and I just added an extra invoice to the doctor. It was that much not premeditated. It was just a regular routine that I was doing. Dr. Pamela Weibel is a personal friend of mine. I met her in an informal synagogue that I was going to in Eugene, Oregon, and she and her husband became friends of mine. We were catching up, and she had mentioned her progression in her career since I had known her in Eugene and what she has done and how she's trying to change medicine, and mentioned one thing that feedback she received. in her community meetings was that people really hated the long wait times. And I mentioned, oh, if I'm kept waiting a long time, I just bill. I'm tired of getting angry. And she said, what? I said, I sent an invoice. I'm tired of getting angry. And she said, do doctors pay it? And I said, about half the time. I've done it, you know, six times in my life. I've gotten paid three times. She's like, you're kidding. I'm like, no, don't other people do this? She said, no. So any case, about a week after that, she called me back and said, I do these little vignettes on my website. Well, can I do yours? And I said, why? And she said, because people will be interested. I'm like, no, they won't. So I basically did it to humor my friend. I mean, I had no interest in doing this. The next day, CNN calls me up and they want to do a story. I said, you're kidding. Well, why is this a story? And they said, we want to do it. So Elizabeth Cohen, a senior correspondent, talked to me on the phone and she did this write-up. It went on CNN.com and it went viral. Pamela and I have had the experience of becoming viral on the internet. It apparently, as you had said, Joe, it really touched a nerve. Since then, I've had two, ABC and CBS, both contact me. I chose to not try to become a public face for this. I'm not trying to seek that. I'm not trying to become a public face, so I turned it down. I have so much respect for the show, your show, and the two of you, that I volunteered and said yes to this, but it's the only one I said yes to.
Well, you were kind enough to bring in an example of the letter and the invoice mm-hmm. that you sent in March of this year to the University Student Healthcare mm-hmm. Service. And the invoice is very straightforward, just looks like a normal invoice because they made you wait more than half an hour and you therefore rescheduled the appointment. And it's a very professional letter telling the doctor, several years ago I decided my time was not free and I no longer give my time away. In my professional life, I charge a consulting rate of $47 an hour. When my time is used by others to wait for them, including doctors, I simply bill for the time rather than get upset. Yeah. How fascinating.
See, and I'm still taken aback that's fascinating. I'm glad. I hope it helps. It's, you know, anybody can do this. I opened up Microsoft Word and used one of their invoice templates. You know, anybody can be a consultant, so you don't have clients. You're a consultant, you know.
What's the message here for our listeners? I mean, you are a somewhat reluctant poster child for this issue of wait times, but what would you like people to take away from this?
So it really hit a hot button, not only with patients, it hit a hot button with doctors. This got on one of the blogs where doctors hang out on the internet, and it got over 300 responses and a lot of really angry doctors as well. A number of them were already stressed out. There's a number of things, you know, it's one of the reasons Pamela left, you know, large medicine. And this was a pressure valve that they could use. If they get behind and stressed out, at least the patients could wait. And here comes somebody saying, wait a minute, that pressure valve is going to cost you money. So it adds more pressure. The real takeaway on this, I think, is that patients are after mutual respect. The six times I did it was when there wasn't respect shown. When I came to the office, a doctor's running behind and nobody let me know ahead of time. I didn't have to come in then. I could have made other arrangements. It's when I'm left waiting needlessly. It's not when the doctor had an emergency and I was told that. That's completely different. Of course, there's times I've been left waiting in medicine when I didn't bill and didn't get upset. There's been times where I came in, they told me he was running behind, I rescheduled and left because I was not an emergency. Those are different. The real takeaway is that patients want respect. This is about mutual respect, and patients become angry when they feel a lack of respect or when the message is that my time is more valuable than your time. That's hitting a real nerve in America. Another thing patients need to be careful of, this is an open market. A doctor can choose to refuse to see you as a patient if you're too much of a pain in the neck. That happened to me once. So there is a cost people need to be aware of.
And of course, a patient can do the same thing.
And that's what most patients do. Most of us, what happens? If we wait too long, we don't like the service, we vote with our feet. We don't go back. That's what most of us do. That's what I do, you know. When I go ahead and bill, but the three of them I billed and I never went back to them ever again. That's what I do too. None of us are seeking to add aggravation to our lives.
Elaine, you've been thinking about this whole time thing a lot, I can tell. And it's about respect. And, you know, there's nothing that drives me crazier than when the cable guy says, I'll be there tomorrow. you know, sometime between 9 and 5. And it's like, oh, my gosh, I have to hang around all day.
Oh, that's if you're lucky. Sometimes they say between 9 a.m. and 7 p.m.
Or they don't come at all and go, oh, we're sorry, we'll come tomorrow instead, after you've already waited half the day.
And I love the cable guy example because that's the number one pet peeve of mine. And in the comments on the medical websites, people were saying, but what about the cable guy? It was coming up there to challenge it. The last time I had cable installed, the man said, well, can you be home between 3 and 6? And I said, I can. It'll cost you $150. And there was dead silence on the other end. And I went, oh, you want me to stay home between 3 and 6 for free? Why would that be an expectation of a company? Why would a company expect you to wait for 3 hours for them for free? In my particular case, people have cell phones. I work 10 minutes away from my house. We made a compromise. I left my schedule at work flexible between 3 and 6, and the driver agreed to call me on his cell phone 10 minutes before he could make it, and we met at my house. We made a compromise. No, I didn't sit and wait at home for the cable guy.
Well, thank you for starting the ball rolling. It sounds like what you have begun may pick up a lot of momentum, and hopefully with doctors like Pam Weibel, who are getting on board with this program, medicine might change.
Yeah, pretty simple acts can make an impact, I found out. I didn't realize it, but I guess it can.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Elaine.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Elaine Farstad. She's an information management consultant whose idea of billing her doctor for excessive waiting time has gotten a lot of attention.
Well, you know, I like this idea of mutual respect, and it's essential for an interaction between a patient and a physician, and there's so much technology now that's available. These wait times really could change.
Well, that's absolutely true. And of course, it's equally important for the patient to be on time for the appointment as it is for the doctor. But, you know, as Elaine pointed out, people do have cell phones, and they can be very useful when you're trying to meet someone on time.
Well, FedEx, for example, if they're going to be possibly late in their delivery, they now let you know you have some options.
Right. They ask if you want to be notified by email or cell phone or text message or some combination of those.
Well, we do need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with physician Pamela Weibel, who helped catapult Elaine's idea to national attention. We'll find out why this story resonates with so many people and what the reaction has been. Is there a double standard in expectations of punctuality for doctors and their patients? We'll also find out why consulting your pharmacist might be the smartest move you could make.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Today on The People's Pharmacy, we're talking about time and why patients value their time as much as physicians value theirs. We turn now to Dr. Pamela Weibel, a nationally recognized innovator in patient-centered care. She was responsible for bringing Elaine's story to national attention.
Welcome to The People's Pharmacy, Dr. Pamela Weibel.
Thank you.
Well, Pamela, you're up to your old funny business.
I am.
You have upset the apple cart yet again. Tell us how all of this started. You have a friend, and you got together informally, and you were catching up, and all of a sudden, this whole thing about billing doctors? Tell us about it.
Yes, please do.
She's a friend, Elaine Farstad, used to just live nearby me in Oregon, and we'd lost touch for about 3 years. And we reconnected, of course, through Facebook, and we're on the phone talking again and catching up on our love life and travels and work situation. I had, of course, told her that I was leading town hall meetings and helping patients design clinics and hospitals that serve their needs rather than experts and politicians' needs. And so she just volunteered to me that what she does when she's kept waiting is bill the doctor. And I thought it was a fantastic idea and something that I had never heard of a patient doing before. And so since I have a little online news show, I went ahead and aired that as a segment. And she gave me permission, of course. She's a pretty private person, but, you know, just between friends, she said, oh, sure, you know, and it took me a while to get a photograph of her, but I went ahead and put it on there. Of course, she had no earthly idea it would go viral like it has. Or she might not have agreed to this.
She might not have. But we have spoken with her, and she shared her experience with us. Tell us, what was the reaction?
It was immediately picked up by CNN within less than 24 hours. They were already interviewing her. I don't even know how they found her, and interviewing me. And then, you know, just a few days later, it was on the front page of CNN Health. And I went ahead and Googled the front portion of the article, the first little phrase, and that popped up 11,000 times. It went to 11,000 other, you know, AM, FM radio stations, Gospel 92.1 in Houston. It went to the Czech Republic, to a major newspaper there. It was kind of all over the place. And then Diane Sawyer used it as her lead story for ABC World News Tonight, Patient Bill of Rights. And today I think it's in, well, yesterday it was in the New York Times, and then the CBS Early Show was calling. I mean, literally I was on the phone with TV producers all month, so. And it's still a live story, which surprises me because it's over a month later and still getting a lot of attention.
Why? Dr. Pamela Weibel, why do you think so many people have reacted with such intensity? And when I say intensity, I mean both positive as well as negative, because some of your medical colleagues weren't too thrilled with this story. So give us the why.
The why is because this has been such a frustration for so long, the excessive wait times and the power differential between doctors and patients, which then, of course, leads to, you know, the kind of piling everyone up waiting for the doctor in the waiting room. So people have not had any recourse or felt like they could do anything. I mean, one woman wrote, I read all 1,260 comments after the CNN piece, and one woman wrote that she, you know, waits 8 to 9 hours for her in-network specialist and doesn't really feel like she has any other options. He's the only one in town. So I think that this sort of solution that Elaine came up with, which was to deal with her frustration, you know, to prevent herself from sitting there and feeling helpless, she went ahead and did what any human being would do who values their self and their time, and went ahead and billed for that. And it gave, I guess, everyone a sense of hope that there is something they can do. And, of course, a lot of doctors have been supportive of this and have written me privately, you know, that I'm a warrior and keep going and, you know, like this is all for the greater good, because honestly what liberates patients will liberate doctors. And but there are, of course, people who are angry and sending me hate mail, physicians who, you know, and the reason why, they're in fight or flight mode, they're in survival mode, and this is kind of one more thing that they're going to have to deal with is a bill. But I think if we look at the underlying reasons and really peel out the root cause, we're all going to be better for it in the long run.
Well, I think you hit it right when you said fight or flight mode. And I just want to say, obviously, patients hate waiting an excessive amount of time, which is only reasonable. We all hate waiting an excessive amount of time for anything. But also, doctors hate it when patients are late. And that happens too, doesn't it, in sort of standard medical practice?
Oh, yeah. In a standard medical practice, many of which are not run very well, you know, there's kind of a, what you would say, like a mutual disrespect going on. So the doctor's late, and then the patient thinks nothing of being late, and sort of, you know, it's kind of like I had a slide once I showed during a presentation that said that patients will fall to a level of dysfunction within a practice. So we attract and perpetuate the same behavior that we have towards others. And so I think if we all kind of stand back and look at the big picture and really start to realize that barring an emergency, when we give somebody an appointment time, you know, either our spouse at a restaurant, our child when we're picking them up from school, or a patient, you know, we really need to be keeping that as an appointment, or else restructuring the practice to run more like a first-come, first-served DMD sort of a scenario. I think that we just need to be honest and transparent in our interactions with each other.
Well, you have written about no double standard. And, you know, there are medical practices where if a patient shows up late, they either get fined or they get told, sorry, you can't see the doctor today. Or if they miss the appointment entirely, they get billed for it.
Right. Yeah, that's and I actually do that myself. I bill patients who cancel less than 24 hours or no show to their appointments. And so, you know, if I were to do that to them, you know, if I would oversleep, for example, and miss an appointment, then I should be held to the same standards. I've never done that, so I have not had to pay a patient, although I do have a gift basket by my door. And if I'm ever more than 10 minutes late, patients get to select a gift just to show that I feel that their time is valuable and that I it goes beyond just an apology. And my friend, Cyrus Picari, who's a physician in Dallas, whom I went to high school with, he actually pays patients and has had to do that. He had a family emergency, canceled all his patients one day. The next day, he handed all of them $50. Each got a $50 check to show that he is also willing to follow through and not have this double standard.
I'm sure a lot of doctors don't like that idea.
No, I mean, but I think that if you get rid of your policy of charging patients for no-show and cancellation fees, of course, there would be no double standard to have to uphold anyway, you know, to deal with. So it's just, I think it's a fascinating topic that Elaine brought up with me in passing in a phone conversation, and it's amazing that it led to such a national discussion.
Well, it fascinates me that you know, so many physicians reacted so negatively, and some have even sent you hate mail. There was one comment that said, next time you or your loved ones have a medical emergency, remember what you posted. Now, this is responding to a person named Patricia. Your doctor probably can't see you because he needs to be on time or else his next patient will bill him. Medicine isn't fast, cheap, and won't solve all your problems. Sort of there's that finger wagging that's going on behind that comment.
Right. And also like a very deep-seated sort of a victim mode. A lot of doctors feel like they are so victimized by the healthcare system and all these third parties that have inserted themselves between the patients and the physicians. And really, the solution is not for us to continue fighting amongst each other, physicians and patients, but come to some agreement and accord. And I think mutual respect is the foundation of our relationships. So, you know, what I'm asking physicians and patients to do is to develop that integrity and trust with each other once again. I mean, I went to a malpractice risk reduction course, and they said essentially that patients do not sue doctors they like. And I mean, most patients, even though if they have a bad outcome, will not sue a physician who they feel cares about them. And certainly, by starting the visit and running your office in a way where you have that mutual respect for somebody's time is going to be the foundation for creating that type of relationship.
Is that practical? Is it feasible? Can it be done?
Oh, certainly it can be done. It can be, I mean, because I've worked in very busy practices, you know, standard, you know, traditional practices, high volume practices in which it's very interesting. There was always one physician that ran 2 hours late, no matter what. And then there was always a physician that was on time. And I was mostly on time, but I spent a lot of time still apologizing for being, you know, 5 or 10 minutes late. But I never kept anyone waiting excessively. Now, there's nothing wrong with the physician who keeps his patients waiting 2 hours because those patients love him and they've learned to bring a magazine and a picnic basket and their crossword puzzles and they make a whole day of it. And so I think if people understand that it's going to be a 2 hour wait, if they love the physician, they're willing to do that. I think the problem arises is when you tell somebody their appointment is at 3 o'clock and they have childcare issues and really need their hourly wage and they have no idea that it's going to be a two-hour wait, you really create a lot of animosity before the appointment ever starts. And so it's just about honesty and communication and transparency and scheduling, I think, because most people are very understanding.
Dr. Pamela Weibel, thank you so much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Pamela Weibel is an innovator in patient-centered care. Her website is idealmedicalcare.org.
There's one place where you don't have to wait very long to consult a healthcare professional. Your local pharmacy not only dispenses medications, but also can provide invaluable advice about how to use your medicines to best effect.
We spoke recently with Mark Gregory, Vice President of Pharmacy and Government Relations at Carr Drug. Carr is recognized as a national leader in medication therapy management. We note that Carr underwrites the People's Pharmacy.
You know, what always fascinates me, because when we go to the pharmacy and we watch how people pick up their medicines, they frequently grab and go.
Big mistake.
It just astonishes me.
Yeah.
It's like people seem to be in such a hurry these days. You know, there's fast food, so they think, you know, we'll just grab and go with our burger. Well, we'll grab and go with our prescription.
The clerk shoves this piece of paper at you that, you know, you're supposed to sign to say you don't want any counseling. I don't even know how many people actually realize that you could say, no, I really do want to talk to the pharmacist.
There is a tremendous knowledge base back in the pharmacy that people are not taking advantage of. We certainly support patients reaching out to their pharmacist when needed. Pharmacists are very accessible and can be made available.
Let's be very specific. I mean, let's take an example, diabetes, because diabetes is an epidemic in this country. We won't get into why it is. It has to do with exercise. It has to do with overweight. It has to do with lifestyle. It has to do with genes. It has to do with a great many factors. It exists. Diabetes medication, monitoring blood sugar, making sure that people hit their target range, those are things that we haven't been as good about as we could be. How could medication therapy management make a difference when it comes to diabetes?
Our patients with diabetes today need a coach. Some folks are actually in denial that they actually have the condition. So when a patient with diabetes sits down with a pharmacist, they look at what are the barriers for taking care of your diabetes. You know, are you having a problem with your diabetes meter? Are your test strips too expensive? The frequency of testing, are you doing that? Do you understand what the readings mean? So really, MTM is a tremendous opportunity for folks with diabetes, a growing condition, can sit down with a pharmacist and look at those issues.
I know when Joe's mother was diagnosed with diabetes many years ago, the very idea of doing her own blood sugar testing just had her pretty freaked out at first. So it's interesting to think that the pharmacist might be able to serve as a coach for someone in that situation. We don't have a lot of other areas where healthcare professionals serve as coaches. So how are pharmacists stepping into this new role?
One of the main barriers that we see is time in the system. And pharmacists are actually engaging with patients with diabetes to spend face-to-face time. We have done a number of things, and our industry has done a number of things as far as reaching out to patients with diabetes via communications, via letter, via telephone, via different refill reminder opportunities. But until we actually sit down face-to-face with that patient with diabetes, do we actually see good results?
It's been our experience that a lot of times people go to different doctors these days. So they're going to the gastroenterologist for their reflux. They may be going to the rheumatologist for their osteoarthritis. They may go to the diabetes expert for their blood sugar problem. They go to the cardiologist for, you know, all of their heart management. And physicians are so busy, they may not have an opportunity to talk with all of the other specialists that that the patient is seeing. The idea of managing all of the medications from all of the different doctors that somebody sees, and in some cases an older person may be taking 5, 10, or even 15 different medications, checking on them to make sure that there's not an incompatibility that is either leading to the reduced effectiveness of one drug or the increased toxicity of another seems like quite a challenge. Is that something that pharmacists are now taking a greater responsibility for monitoring?
I think that's the only way that, you know, certainly these comprehensive medication reviews can actually take place because of the fragmentation of the drug distribution process and folks taking advantage of many different specialists. So we are migrating also, hopefully, to one medical record that includes all of the medications, right, all the medical records to a common health information platform. You know, we are evolving towards that. But in the meantime, there's an important element of folks bringing all of their medications into a comprehensive medication scenario.
Mark Gregory, thanks so much for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today.
Thanks, Joe and Terry.
Mark Gregory is Vice President of Pharmacy and Government Relations at Carr Drug and underwriter of The People's Pharmacy. MTM stands for Medication Therapy Management. It's an important role for today's pharmacist.
It's time for us to take a short break. When we come back, we'll find out why sleep deprivation is dangerous for physicians as well as patients.
Will new rules limiting residents' work hours make hospitals safer?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Red X Industries, makers of Utterly Smooth Foot Cream with Shea Butter, helping dry, cracked feet feel soft and smooth. 800-345-7339, online at uttercream.com.
And by Carr Drug, nationally recognized for rethinking the role of community pharmacy through its community healthcare centers, offering immunization screenings and medication counseling, online at carrdrug.com.
If you would like to order a CD of today's show or any other People's Pharmacy broadcast, you can call 800-732-2334. Today's show is number 824. That number again, 800-732-2334. You can also find it at peoplespharmacy.com.
Today on The People's Pharmacy, we're looking at the stories behind the health headlines. One little noted headline was a recent change in work rules for first-year residents. These doctors in training are now limited to working no more than 16 hours straight without rest.
To find out why that matters to the rest of us, we spoke with Dr. Christopher Landrigan, Associate Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and a leader in patient safety.
As Director of the Sleep and Patient Safety Program at Brigham and Women's Hospital, you've been a leading advocate of doctors having time to get adequate sleep. A lot of patients would feel safer if our doctors were well rested. Dr. Landrigan, what does the research show?
It's, as you know well, been well recognized for more than a decade now that a large number of patients in hospitals across the United States are killed and injured as a consequence, unfortunately, of medical errors. And when I first began looking into this issue back in the late 90s and early 2000s, I was struck by the fact that there was almost no literature at that time that was really explicitly linking this epidemic of medical errors that was becoming recognized at that time with doctors' working conditions. From my own experiences as a resident, I knew that when I was sleep-deprived and been up for too many hours in a row, my ability to think clearly and do the right thing really deteriorated. And so was interested in the topic and was looking around at what was known. And while on the one hand, there was about 30 years at that point of science from the fields of sleep and circadian biology demonstrating very convincingly that people are profoundly impaired once they've been up for that many hours in a row. There was almost nothing that had linked this with the patient safety movement. And so at that time, about 10 years ago now, a series of colleagues here, both patient safety folks as well as sleep experts and I, began researching the topic. And we really did this in two ways. The first was to conduct a national cohort study where we got about 3,000 interns and residents from around the country to report to us on a monthly basis what their work hours were, what their sleep was, and so forth. And then anytime they had a motor vehicle crash or a needle stick injury or made a medical error, we had them send us a report of that and validated those things in various ways. And at the same time, we conducted a randomized controlled trial here at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, where we looked at what the impact would be of eliminating these types of long shifts for interns in particular. And we found that when we got rid of these shifts, the rates of medical errors dropped off very substantially. And both of these lines of research really have demonstrated in various ways that, first of all, when doctors are up for many hours in a row, they're extremely sleep-deprived, and secondly, that if we get rid of those long hours, we can make the situation better. And that work has now been replicated by investigators all over the country in a variety of different institutions.
Dr. Landrigan, you've mentioned long shifts. How long?
Well, I think it's actually probably a surprise to many people that in hospitals across the country, doctors continue to work for shifts of certainly up to 28 to 30 hours in a row on a routine basis. And in some institutions and some specialties, it often exceeds even that level.
Well, let's dial back, if you don't mind, Dr. Landrigan. And, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, perhaps when you were a resident, people could work more than 80 hours a week.
That's right. Yeah, at the time that I was a resident, there were no limits whatsoever on the number of hours that residents work. And I think it's worth pointing out that there are still no limits of any kind on the number of hours that doctors who are beyond their training, so attending physicians, the senior doctors, as well as nurses work in this country. Although there have been in the past few years some what I would call relatively modest limits introduced for resident physicians.
So in 2003, there were some limits that were placed. One was that residents could not work more than 80 hours a week, and they could only work up to 30-hour shifts. Wow. What progress, huh?
Right.
What happened after 2003?
Well, since 2003, a lot of research has continued to come out that has demonstrated, I think probably not very surprisingly to the general public, that those types of shifts are still really unsafe, both for the doctors themselves and for their patients. And in response to that, Congress called on the Institute of Medicine, which is a sort of external body. It's a branch of the National Academy of Science, to do a really intensive investigation of this body of research and come up with recommendations as to whether the current standards were appropriate or not. And at the very beginning of 2009, they came out with a report that has said essentially that it's unsafe for doctors in training, for residents of any level, to be working for more than 16 hours in a row without sleep. And they called on a number of solutions to fix the problem, including shortening shifts, building potentially protected sleep time into longer shifts, improving supervision, improving other types of working conditions that were routinely happening in hospitals. And both in response to that report, as well as external pressure from a number of organizations, the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, which is really the professional body that's tasked with dealing with this issue, just this past month, in July of 2011, implemented limits for interns, first-year residents only, that were much more substantial than what existed before, and are still fairly long, I think, by the standards of other industries. But now interns, those first-year residents, are limited to no more than 16 hours in a row of work. So the 24-hour shifts are eliminated altogether. But that said, for everyone else, for the second-year residents and higher, they're still allowed to work for shifts of up to 28 hours in a row, which we know is well beyond what's safe.
Anytime there's a change, there are people who are unhappy about the change. And some of the objections that have been raised to this new limit on working hours involve actually patient safety. There have been people saying, well, if first-year residents can only work 16 hours at a time, that means you'll have to have more handoffs. And we know that handoffs are risky. So what's the response to that, Dr. Landrigan?
And please explain this notion of handoffs and harm.
Sure, sure. So first of all, the notion of handoffs and harm is really around the manner in which medicine is organized and whether we think of ourselves as individual practitioners or members of a team. historically, medicine has really been all about the individual doctor and patient relationship, at least back in the days of shingles and country doctors. And I think that a lot of doctors still envision themselves that way. Much of medical education is geared around trying to optimize individual knowledge and understanding of patients, with the expectation that if a doctor knows enough, then the right things will happen and patient care will be safe. I think we know that the reality is much more complicated than that, and especially in hospitals where there are many, many providers, nurses and doctors alike, specialists and generalists taking care of a single patient. And in the past 10 or 12 years, since the patient safety movement here really took off, it's been increasingly recognized that the communications between those groups and their ability to work effectively as teams is a really critical component of the safety of care that patients receive generally. And so one of the concerns, getting back to your point from before, about what might happen if you reduce doctors' work hours is this notion of, well, won't that lead to more transitions in care? And if we know that transitions in care between doctors and their communication skills and so forth are problematic anyway, isn't that just going to make care less safe? There are really, in my mind, two fundamental problems with that argument. The first one is that it completely runs counter to what the evidence shows us, which is that in virtually all of the experiments where doctors' work hours actually have been reduced, it has not been the case that handoff problems have become more problematic. In fact, quite the contrary. In a systematic review that we did recently, 7 out of 11 studies that have tested these types of changes have found statistically significant improvements in patient safety after the change was made, and the other 4 showed that things were more or less equivalent. There's not a single study that's shown that care becomes less safe when you eliminate 24-hour shifts.
We've heard the argument that having longer shifts is crucial. I mean, not just important, but crucial for training residents because they have to be taught to recognize and manage fatigue. Is that possible?
No. So the science, again, here would very strongly indicate that one cannot learn to deal adequately with the effects of sleep deprivation. At the same time, it also shows us that people who are chronically sleep-deprived lose the ability to recognize that they're impaired as a consequence of it and have the very interesting tendency to believe that they're learning to cope with it, despite the fact that objective evidence shows that they're not. So in other words, if you restrict somebody's sleep over a period of, let's say, 14 days to 4 hours of sleep or 6 hours of sleep per night, over that period of time, you can see every day that their performance is being impaired day by day, worse and worse each day with this consecutive restriction of sleep. But if you ask them how they're doing, the interesting phenomenon occurs that for the first 2 or 3 days, they recognize that they're doing worse than they were when they started. But by days 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, they start feeling like they're accommodating to it and beginning to do okay. Yet, when you test them objectively, that's not the case at all. And so we know that people can't learn to compensate for sleep loss in that manner. And this sort of notion is really, I think, ill-conceived, both on the part of medicine and in some other sectors as well.
Does that mean then that the major objection to actually making residents' work hours more humanly possible is an economic objection?
Well, I think it's both cultural and economic. Despite the science that shows that you can't learn to cope with these types of things and that these sorts of long shifts are not in the interest either of patients or of the doctors themselves, there's a strong attachment to them on the part of many who have gone through medical training. And I think of part of it as it's really a mechanism of rationalization of what they've gone through themselves in many cases, where, you know, doctors have gone through these grueling schedules as trainees to learn to become excellent doctors. At the end of the day, the excellent doctors look back and say, well, I'm a good doctor. This is the training that I went through. And there's sort of this logical fallacy of thinking I'm a good doctor because I went through this type of a training program, which I think is unfortunately really, really misplaced, but also quite common. But on top of that, I think the personal attachments that people have to these types of schedules and training mechanisms, there certainly is an economic ramification as well. Residents are fairly cheap labor in hospitals. They spend the large majority of their time in hospitals not getting formal training that's detached from patient care, but really learning by providing direct patient care. And they are, as a consequence, the major frontline providers, at least from a physician standpoint, in most teaching hospitals around the country, which are our largest hospitals and our most prestigious hospitals around the country. And as a consequence, cutting down their hours and trying to find adequate replacement, while it might, in the end, actually save money if this type of an intervention reduced adverse events to patients in the manner that I and many other experts expect that it would. At least in the short term, there's an upfront cost to finding replacement providers to fill that gap.
So, Dr. Christopher Landrigan, what is the solution to this problem? I mean, I personally am not even thrilled with the idea of 16-hour work shifts. I'd like to see it more like, 8 to 12 hours, but that may be unrealistic at this time and place. So what is the message for our listeners, for patients who have to interact in hospitals with residents who may have been working for more than 24 hours at a time?
Well, I think it's a tough problem. I think for the patients when they walk in the doors of these institutions, as these are the way that things are typically set up, and I think you are right in being concerned about 16-hour shifts. We know that even with the 16-hour shifts, there is some degree of neurocognitive impairment and the propensity to err and to have alertness lapses and vigilance lapses towards the tail end of that tends to go up as well. And it is, I think, a pragmatic issue now of what's a realistic improvement that could be achieved based on where things are right now, with the hope that we'll continue to study this as time goes by and implement safer policies as things evolve. But I think the solutions in the short term are, first of all, we need to have reasonable limits put in place, not just for the interns, but for more senior doctors as well. It doesn't make any sense biologically or from the safety literature to say we have enough data to suggest that first-year residents make many more mistakes when they're sleep-deprived, but that somehow doesn't apply as soon as the second year of residency begins. And we know that that's irrational and that those limits ought to be put in place. But that has to be accompanied by a reasonable investment up front in improving hospital infrastructure so that they can cope with that. To simply put hour limits in place without building up the handoff process, without thinking constructively about medical education, without thinking about workforce issues and who's going to fill in these gaps is not helpful. And in order to achieve that, we actually convened a conference of policymakers here at Harvard about a year ago. Folks from the Joint Commission and from Medicare and from various payer organizations, as well as residents and patient advocates and the like, to ask them to kind of think about solutions to how these things could be brought about. And the strong feeling was that in order to accomplish this, there needs to be investment from all of these parties up front. So we know, for example, that from a cost standpoint, if we could reduce adverse events by something like 10 or 11%, then all of these changes at the Institute of Medicine is recommending would pay for themselves. And we know from the research that studies that have implemented these types of shift limits for interns have reduced adverse events by at least that amount. And so if you can get everybody in the room together and align incentives, this is something that could be extremely cost-effective, could in fact be cost-saving potentially. But if you leave it up to the hospitals, who are not the people that reap the economic benefit of more efficient care, to pay for it, then it becomes something that's very difficult to do. So there's lots of alignment that has to happen from a policy perspective, and we also just need reasonable rules in place for everybody.
In the short term, is it fair or reasonable for a patient to ask a resident or even their physician, how many hours have you been working? And if it's more than 16 or 20, is it fair to ask for a different physician?
It's certainly a reasonable question to ask, and we conducted a survey of the general public that came out about a year ago now, asking them just these sorts of questions. How many hours do you think doctors work currently? What do you think are appropriate limits? And if you found out that a doctor was working for 24 hours in a row, would you be comfortable with that? Would you ask for another doctor and so forth? And there were several surprising things from that study. The first was that only about 3% of the general public was even aware that doctors work these kinds of hours. But once they were informed and knew that this was taking place, almost universally the general public disapproves of this sort of thing, and the vast majority of folks who we asked would be very uncomfortable with a doctor working those types of hours and would ask to have a different physician care for them under those circumstances. And so, yes, I think very much that patients are an important player in this situation, and their ability to advocate for themselves is good not only for their own safety immediately, but also for as a means of hopefully eventually getting the system to change.
Dr. Christopher Landrigan, we really want to thank you for talking with us about this important issue on the People's Pharmacy today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Dr. Christopher Landrigan, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's also Associate Professor in the Division of Sleep Medicine in the Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, where he also directs the Sleep and Patient Safety Program.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Peter Bombar and Al Wadarski engineer the program. Dave Graydon edits our interviews.
The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Blue Lizard Australian Sun Cream, providing high protection against both UVA and UVB sun exposure, and Blue Lizard Sensitive with zinc oxide for delicate skin. The number is 800-334-4286, on the web at bluelizard.net.
And by CardDrug, nationally recognized for expanding the role of pharmacy beyond the counter through its community health centers and medication therapy management programs. Locations in communities across North Carolina, online at kerrdrug.com.
The People's Pharmacy theme music is by B.J. Lederman.
The People's Pharmacy is produced at the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
To order a CD of today's show or any People's Pharmacy broadcast, you can call 800-732-2334. Today's show is number 824, or you can find it on the website, peoplespharmacy.com.
When you go to the site, you can find detailed information about prescription medications, herbs, and home remedies. And you'll also find an extended interview with Mark Gregory, Vice President of Pharmacy and Government Relations at CardDrug, about the value of consulting your pharmacist.
When you go to the website, you can vote on today's show, share your own story, or check out our new home remedy book from National Geographic. You can sign up for our free electronic newsletter or subscribe to the free podcast of our show. It will be delivered straight to your computer, and you'll never miss another People's Pharmacy program again. It's all there at peoplespharmacy.com.
Next week on The People's Pharmacy, we'll hear how patients and doctors can use online technology to improve healthcare.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.